afternoon and welcome, everyone. My name is Kimberly Begg. I am the president of the Luce Center. We are a nonprofit organization that specializes in the conservative outreach, education, and mentorship of young women for the purpose of preparing and promoting conservative women leaders. We invest in conservative women because they are the trustees of a free and flourishing society. We have a fantastic program for you today. Sarah Kane is here with us. Sarah is a really remarkable young woman. I first became familiar with her work a few years ago. She is a frequent guest on a lot of excellent conservative radio shows. And she just shared with me the news. May I share this? That she is going to be co-hosting her own radio show. So if you are not already familiar with her work, you will be very soon. But we're thrilled to have her here. And we will give her a proper introduction in just a few minutes. But first, I would like to say just a few words about some upcoming events. We have four campus events on campuses across the country going on in the next 5 days, which is all very, very exciting. So tomorrow, we are going to be at the University of Dallas for a very special firearms training. We have a Day at the Range program that's going to be happening there. And we are going to have college students and UD professors and some local women professionals who are going to be joining us. And we have a very special speaker who's going to be joining us as well. So Dr. Susan Hansen, who's an associate professor of history at UD, is going to be speaking on the importance of American patriotism. We also have Liz Wheeler, who's going to be speaking for us at Hillsdale College, and K.T. McFarland, who is going to be with us at Muhlenberg College. And all three of these events, by the way, have been organized by recent interns. So some of you may have already met some of the exceptional young women who are going to be hosting these fantastic events on their campuses. In addition, I am going to be speaking at Belmont Abbey College in North Carolina next week. Now, it's hard to believe that it is November already, and the end of the year is right around the corner. We have one more event here before the end of the year that I'm hoping that you will all join us at. So Becky Norton Dunlop is going to be speaking here at December 12th on the conservative movement in the age of Trump. So that will be, I think, a very interesting event, and I do hope that you will be here for it. Now, I would like to welcome up my wonderful colleague and intern who's been here working in our office for the last few months. Lucy Evich is going to be introducing our speaker. Lucy?
Good afternoon, everyone. I have the great honor of introducing today's speaker. Sarah Kane, known as the Crusader Gal, is a political and cultural commentator and author of Failing Foundations, The Pillars of the West Are Nearing Collapse. Originally from England, she entered the British political scene at the age of 12, driven by a desire to address the challenges facing her country. After moving to the United States, she spent more than a decade working in health research before, in 2018, turning her attention to political and cultural commentary. Drawing on the parallels she has observed between British and American decline, she uses Britain as a case study to warn Americans about the consequences of hate speech legislation, the erosion of self-defense protections, and other cultural and legal shifts. Sarah's public work appears in a variety of conservative publications, including Crisis Magazine, as well as in her own newsletter, The Homefront Crusade, where she analyzes the trajectory of modern culture. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Sarah Kane.
Thank you all for coming out today. So I know that we're all in a bit of a strange moment here as conservatives, right after a government shutdown, because there's no conservative who doesn't have at least mixed feelings about government shutdowns. Like, what do you mean all the non-essential services stopped by the government. I didn't notice, right? And so, you know, it's like we stopped all the different studies on quail on cocaine and how far shrimp can go on a treadmill. Those were actual studies, by the way, that our government has funded. But we're also in a strange moment as conservatives, because very few people can say what conservatives are defending right now. And even fewer can really articulate why it's important that we're defending this thing that so few can define. And if you ask someone, you'll often get some of the same things. You'll hear smaller government, lower taxes. Those are the top two. And I think the reason for that is because they're safe. You're at a hairdresser and someone's cutting your hair and somehow your conversation gets moved towards politics and they say, where do you stand? And you say, I want smaller government and lower taxes. You're pretty safe in that scenario, right? At the same time, I don't think that those topics by themselves are topics that are worth defending in the sense that they're worth spending your life on. They're not worth getting shot for, not worth dying for. But I think that conservatism more broadly is. See, the problem isn't just that our government is big. Our government is big. It's always getting bigger for the most part. But it's also immoral. And that's the problem that we have. We don't have problems with big forces that are actually doing good things, big forces that are moral bodies. We have problems with things that are big using our tax money for the advocation of what we consider to be evils. That's what we have a problem with. So if we get away from the topic of fiscal conservatism, which is safe, and we get more broadly into social conservatism, which is less safe in terms of public speaking, but is much more important and that is worth giving your life to. Well, it's uncomfortable because you end up having to define terms, speak about things that matter most, things like the defense of the family. And then as soon as you say family, someone's going to say, well, define what you mean by family. And you're going to have to actually define it and explain why the natural family matters, and maybe even explain how we can deduce the natural family from the order of creation. The sense that men and women were made for each other because, quite simply, they fit together. And even that when you combine them, they have procreative potential. We know this. You and I, we know these things, but yet, you know, this isn't something that's talked about that often. And it gets really confusing and difficult when you're speaking to a person who is so miseducated, so maleducated, that he has come to doubt or deny the obvious, that he can no longer look at family and see it as a thing that he really understands anymore. Because every truth, every universal, has been reduced to a mere social construct. And that's where we are. But why this matters and why it's worth fighting for, even if you just take just this one concept of the family, it alone, well, the family is the foundation of civilization. It is the building block of every healthy society that ever was. And that's why it's under attack in the ways that it is. And family, of course, starts with marriage itself. And so that's under attack in different ways. One of those ways is to deny that people need to get married at all, because the foundation of family is marriage. And so if you deny that people have to get married at all, well, then you just have people having various promiscuous relationships that they don't think matters, that they don't think affects their soul, even though it actually does. And then you have couples who, even when they're monogamous, they're doing things that married people do, and they think that it bears moral equivalency. And so they move in together and they perform what we used to call the marriage act. And sometimes they beget children, but they're less likely to. They're a lot less likely to beget children when they're in these couples, but they're not married. And that's because the woman, she'll, you know, get pregnant. They're still doing the same things. But then they're going to say, well, now this object of permanence, hitherto called a child, this object of permanence has entered a non-permanent situation. We never said this was permanent. We never took a vow. Things are really getting scary now for one or for both, you know, your participants here. Things are really getting scary now because now it's permanent and we were in a temporary situation. And you're asking for a permanent commitment. And that's one of the ways that, oh, suddenly this couple that thought that they were equivalent to a married couple are suddenly thinking about things in a way that is very different to a couple that were actually married. And then you have the reducing of marriage to simply a piece of paper. And I mean this not just with that couple I just talked about, but in the sense of the classical understanding of what do we mean when we talk about a marriage. And I think most of us actually have this wrong, even as conservatives, because we think of it as two people and the state is respecting the institution that they've chosen and that's about it. What we used to say is, I think that the best equivalency is to look at another family unit. Look at a mother and her son. Doesn't matter how estranged they ever get, how many fights they have. We all recognize that she's still the mother and he's still the son. It doesn't matter if they're on the opposite sides of the planet. You can't change that. It's intrinsic. It's who they are. It is the relationship that they are in. That's the way that we used to see marriage. That their relationship to each other was such that it was thereafter not changeable. If their marriage was valid, it was. It was who they are. They are now a wife. They are now a husband. And because we've instead reduced it to a piece of paper, even just in our speech and the way that we think about things, that if things get bad enough, or if something's really messed up, even by my standards, even if something's really messed up, they're still married. And we've gotten away from that. We don't really understand what it is. And so that's why we're introducing things like no-fault divorce and so on. It's because we don't really understand, oh, that you are actually married, and that actually means something beyond whether or not you have the piece of paper. And then the sort of next gradual step is what increasingly conservatives won't say, but I will, which is homosexual marriage. Because you've gotten to that point where you're no longer willing to say, well, this is what a marriage is, and this is what it's ordered towards, the beginning of children. And also, you're willing to redefine it, because we just did redefine it. We redefined it into something that really is just who you are before the state. Right? And so at that point, we in the broadest sense, I know you didn't, I know that I didn't, but we changed the dictionary. Right? We literally changed what marriage is defined as. And we've embraced that. And I think that too many people are willing to say, well, yeah, but it's easier to just sort of accept in the sense of, it's not my battle. It's really not the government's business to be inside of marriage anyway. And even if you want to say that, it's still your business. It's still your business to care about what marriage is, because it's your business to care about civilization, because in the very least, we all have to live in it. And there are consequences down the road to getting rid of this foundational piece of what civilization is. And of course, the next step, generally speaking, is going to be polygamy, which is a lot easier to defend in a marriage concept than homosexual marriage, actually, which is what's really unnerving. So when that goes to the courts, it's going to be very difficult to sort of edge that out and figure out, well, why can we accept one and not the other when we just defined it as something that recognizes who you are before the state, and that's all it is. And that's the sort of the slippery slope, not really a fallacy, but more of a trajectory. So if we're conservatives, we're conserving. And you've heard the natural law phrasing probably quite a bit. I'm sure you've heard lots of people saying, we get our rights from God. Of course you have. And it's true, we do. But we've lost the other half of that, lost a lot of natural law understanding, even though we still kind of, in a side way, reference it. But we used to understand our rights existed in concordance with our duties. And we've lost the second half, and so we can't really keep the first. We're trying, but it's not working. So I want to walk through some of these with you so you can kind of see what I mean. Because most people nowadays will herald rights, and they'll invent rights even. You see that a lot right now, the invention of rights on the spot. But they don't understand where they come from because they don't understand the sense of duty. So like you've got the right to self-defense. It's an important right. But why do we have that? It's because we have a duty to be good stewards of our own bodies given as a gift in itself, and because we have a duty to defend those in our care. It is amazing how when you speak about rights, it becomes instantly political. It shouldn't be. Rights was something that was supposed to be so foundational that we all agreed about this. You know, we disagreed about the more tangential things. We didn't disagree about rights, and yet you talk about self-defense and suddenly you're partisan. It's rather a strange time in which we live. And then you have the right to practice religion. That comes from the duty to worship your creator. We are created. We have a duty to worship. And then one that's been in the news a lot recently, and that is a nation has a right to defend its borders. Why? Because it has a duty to those there within. Right? And so you have this constant give and take, this constant, there's a why to the right. And then the one that's perhaps spoken about most, and not wrongly, is free speech, your right to speak freely. Well, what's the duty? The duty is the right to speak the truth. Now, that part we've certainly forgotten, but it was never about your right to speak error. It was about your duty to speak that which is true. And you can go back all the way. It was never about speech that is demonstrably false. So defamation laws, which is like slander and libel, they both fall under defamation, when you're intentionally saying something false about another person to harm his reputation. These go back in English common law to the 1200s. They go back in America to the 1600s, was the earliest defamation laws we have before there really was in America, so to speak. But you had that free speech, that duty to speak the truth, your duty not to be silent, which is kind of rather novel in nowadays. But you would think that listening to this, that speech couldn't be limited in a civilized country. And I guess it depends on what you consider civilized. But if you equate civilized with industrialized, then it's certainly not the case. Because I think when Americans travel, they're surprised at the fact that in other countries besides the US, they all have variations of hate speech legislation, all of them. And so all the countries that you consider to be civilized, whether it's England or Australia or Canada, all of these countries that are considered like top tier nations in terms of freedom, they all prohibit speech. They all have people arrested for that. And most familiar with English policies, but there in 2016, the last year in which they were counting, 9 people a year were questioned and detained. Half of those were prosecuted. Now, before we just kind of overfixate on the number and then move on, imagine that. Imagine the terrorism on a personal level, because it's easy to take a number and just to kind of go, okay, well, that's interesting, 9 a day. But imagine this, because it doesn't matter how much you back the blue. If police officers knock on your door and you didn't call them, it's not a good day, right? But that's what happened to these people. Somebody, law enforcement officers, knocked on their door and then had them lawfully detained because of something they said on Facebook or on Twitter. Like, imagine what that actually feels like. Or worse, imagine those same law enforcement professionals knocked on your door and wanted to speak to your husband or your wife or your child because your teenage son said something on Twitter that caused offense. Because that's against the law in England. Not saying something that's wrong, but saying something that caused offense. Because we kind of switched the responsibility here from the duty to speak truth to the right not to be offended. Now, what duty correlates to the right not to be offended? There is none, because it's not a right. And again, that's one of the easiest ways to look at and say, that's actually not a right. That's not how that works. So that's, you know, they stopped collecting data on hate speech arrests, as in that we could look at anyway during COVID. Read into that what you will, but they just stopped counting. They stopped putting the data out there about how many arrests they were making because of people offending other people. So we've lost this second half of the rights and duties equation. I'll tell you why. The argument of duties is actually itself a religious argument. Because you've got yourself standing there as one person. How could you possibly have duties? How could you, as one person, have responsibilities simply being held in existence? It itself is a transcendent argument. You may not like the fact that it is, but it simply is. But it further means that if you have duties, you also have purpose. You also have a purpose for your being. And those that we're fighting against oppose this notion, this fundamentally Christian ethos, because that was part of it. Our entire natural law framework is based upon this understanding of the human being being a created being and therefore having duties. And therefore, because he has duties, likewise having rights. And so that's why you have conservative groups always on the defense, protecting rights. The Alliance Defending Freedom, always, it's 95% of what they do, is defend people who are exercising their basic rights, their right to religion, their right to free speech. That's what they do. And again, this concept of rights should not be an issue of political partisanship, technically speaking. It simply is in our particular moment. Because our enemies, and we do have them, are trying to move us toward an anti-Christian society, in which there is zero tolerance for lived Christianity. Like, yes, you can be a Christian in your home, just not out here where the real people are, where things actually get done, not in your workplace, not in public, it's not anywhere that actually matters. And that's what they're really saying. There's this zero tolerance for lived Christianity, but it's occurring under false auspices. The auspices that we're moving towards an a-religious society. It's false. We're not moving towards an a-religious society, but there is this attempt to make us feel like we are. Because we're not moving, you know, to be anti-Christian. We're just moving to be secular and advanced and progressive. You've heard the terms. And therefore, we're moving away from primitivism. That's what we're really doing. We're moving away from all the errors of the past. That's the argument that's being made. You'll notice, though, even though that's the argument that's being made, when they're forcing the guy to make the cake for the faux gay wedding, they're not knocking on the door of the Muslim baker. And it's not simply because they value their heads, though I am saying, I concede that that might be part of the equation. But likewise, when they're suing women photographers who, well, they take pictures, because they refused to take pictures for a faux homosexual wedding, when Orthodox Jews either. They're specifically and repeatedly attacking Christianity specifically. We're not moving to be anti-religion. We're moving specifically to be anti-Christian. It matters because our civilization, the West, hitherto called Christendom, literally was underpinned by these very explicitly Christian values. And I'll tell you, to go back to England again, because I know so much about the political landscape and where that went. They likewise had the same argument. We're not moving to be anti-Christian. We're just progressive. We're just moving to be healthy and reasonable. We're just embracing the rational. It's all these same things. Then you had this massive immigration attempt. Oh, not an attempt. It was successful. From Iraq and from Pakistan and from Somalia, from Muslim places. So you had a massive influx of Muslims, first and second generation. And, well, that got rather complicated because what actually happened was that a lot of these younger Muslim men formed gangs in which they attacked and specifically targeted non-Muslim, I hesitate to call them women, because they were between the ages of 12 and 15, typically speaking. Right? And they targeted these girls specifically because they were not Muslim. They considered that to be their practice of religion in part, and part of their conquest. And that's actually been written about and documented. Why I bring this up is not because some people did bad things. That happens. It happens everywhere. What's more notable is what happened in response to that, which is that the British government refused to prosecute for decades. They knew these things were happening, but nothing was done. The police refused to make arrests. The Crown Prosecution Service, that's basically a DA's office, but it occurs on a national level, they refused to prosecute. Tens of thousands of girls were made victim by that. These girls weren't just assaulted. They were assaulted in groups. And then those few girls who had the temerity and courage to come forward and explain what had happened to their parents and to the police were oftentimes threatened with arrest themselves because they had admitted to drinking underage or something to that effect. That isn't moving towards an anti-religious society. At the very least, it's religious preferentialism for a specific religious group. And increasingly you have that. They say that nature abhors a vacuum. You do kind of see that in some of these scenarios where suddenly, if it was, let's take an alternative, scenario. If you had a group of Christian men who decided that they were going to engage in something like that and specifically target another religious group in order to engage in mass child rapes, would we look in a different direction? Would we avoid upsetting public relations by doing so, which is what they claimed that they were doing? I don't think so. That was the injustice and the evil of what took place under the auspices of doing something good because we're moving towards a freer society. The very same arguments that are being made here in the United States. And so we claim to be moving towards this freer society by moving towards secularism. But what about when we see that in action? Well, then we have things like hate speech laws. You know what hate speech laws remind me of? Blasphemy laws. Because right there, you have laws against specific speech. What we've changed really isn't the fact that we have these laws, it's just we've changed who God is. That's what's happened. Instead, we're more than willing to arrest people, to terrorize people for saying something offensive against a certain group that we've elevated to a deity of its own. Because I don't think there are really, truly a-religious societies. I don't think they've ever existed. I'll get to that more in a second. But that's what we're seeing when we look at these hate speech laws that protect certain groups from criticism by specific other groups. What we're actually seeing is blasphemy laws presented differently and enforced with far more vigor than actual blasphemy laws ever were. Far more aggressively and much more vigorously enforced. And then here's something that's already right here in America, because hate speech laws aren't fully here yet. Like, you see a lot of the underpinnings. Most people in college campuses are in favor of hate speech laws when they are polled. Most young people think that hate speech laws in America are a good thing. But then you go to hate crime laws. They are on the books here in the United States. And so a hate crime law, what it does is it destroys people's lives for what would have otherwise been minor offenses on the basis of the fact that one of our privileged groups is being targeted. And so again, you end up with a different godlike figure. This is what I mean by you don't really have a-religious societies. We've just chosen a religion that's pretty evil. And that's where we are. So if you have a person who, burns some rubber on some rainbow crosswalk, well, it may have been a misdemeanor, if that. But now he's fighting for decades of his life because he committed a hate crime. Well, what is that other than the government really enforcing not hate speech laws, but thought crime laws? Because what we're doing is we're inferring what his motivation was and saying, we don't like that motivation. We don't like the thoughts that you have. We don't like the values that you have. That's what we're actually doing. We're not better than former Christendom. We have just chosen very different gods. Likewise, you look over in many U.S. states, but I'm reminded specifically of a case in Washington state where an individual, he took a rainbow flag off of a sacrilegious church and he burned it. And ordinarily speaking, you know, it's a misdemeanor. Yes, you stole some property and it probably cost about $20 and you destroyed the property. So, you know, you're going to get a fine, most likely. You might get up to a month in jail. But instead, he got 18 years. Because that's hate crime legislation. That's hate crime legislation saying, we don't like what it is that you believe. And so when I think we often are saying, well, we've got the First Amendment here, so they're not really going to do anything about our speech. And it's true. It really has been really helpful to have that written in the Bill of Rights. But even thought crime laws are already here under the guise of hate crime. That's one of the battles that we should be fighting. And instead, I think we've overseeded. We've given it up. We don't think that that's something that we should fight, but we have to, because it is the elevation of a series of false gods that's undermining real values. And you don't have an a-religious society. Look even at countries that claim to be a-religious. Look at something like China. And what you have there is the elevation of the state to their god. Look at North Korea, I think is a little bit more demonstrative, because you've got their photos that they're basically required to worship of leader and former leaders. Man himself is a political and religious creature. And so we don't do well with this vacuum of what it is that we love and what it is that we worship. But you can see what it is that we love and we worship and what it is that we defend in terms of our laws. That's what you actually see. And so as we attempt to build a society without the Christian underpinning, you know, that we've talked about, even like in American natural law, albeit Lockean sense, even when you remove all of that, the other elements begin toppling. Like we've talked about the connection of rights and duties, but it's also our understanding of ourselves that topples as well. Because the West is in something of an identity crisis right now. And as a result, individuals are as well, especially young people, because we're raising people without any understanding of who they are and what they are. Remember how if you don't have your duties, they come from that understanding of you in relation to a creator, in the very least, right? Well, if you remove all of that, you remove the creation, you remove the duties, you remove the inherent responsibilities, and thus you remove the purpose, that leaves a person purposeless, right? And so I think girls and boys, they respond differently to this, but it's terrible because it's counter to what we were made for. So the girl or young woman who sells her body on OnlyFans, she's paralleled by the boy who goes into the supermarket and takes a gun and starts shooting people. It's the same nihilistic worldview that says, I want to matter, please pay attention to me. Whether it's, you know, the woman who's receiving the attention in the terms of money, or if it's the individual who he has his network online, but he wants to really impress and he wants to make it into the papers because he wants to be significant in some way. Because this sense that we're entirely insignificant ourselves, it's contrary to how we were made. We weren't supposed to be like that. It's just isolated vessels, fiercely individualistic. And that's what we're kind of raising people to be. And so even if you had in 2022, a Supreme Court Justice Kavanaugh was targeted. And the young man who was arrested with a plan to execute him, he said, I just wanted to matter. That's what it is. We're breeding people with that sense that they don't matter and they can't matter. We have these different expressions of despair. They don't know why they do, and they're desperate for someone to say that they do. And then if you look at the entire trans movement, it's, look at me. I'm unique in my gender, even. I have this one gender that nobody else has, because there are infinite versions, infinite varieties. So it's argued. That's the claim. And it's difficult to get more attention nowadays than to mutilate yourself in this way. That's what we're telling young people implicitly, that we'll pay the most attention to you if you mutilate yourself physically, if you take hormones that have permanent effects upon your fertility. You'll get, you know, visits to the White House with then President Biden. That's what happened on TV. That's the way to get the attention, so to speak. And then we're demanded to assent to that. And I want to talk about this for a second because it's so perverse in a lot of ways. This question that we're supposed to agree to a person's false notion that he is the other sex. Because it's demanded of us in the name of compassion. That out of compassion, we should say, yes, you are that thing that you think that you are, but which you are not. And that's what's really tragic is that the moral dubiousness of going up to somebody who's in the midst of an identity crisis, who doesn't know why they matter, who doesn't know what they are fundamentally, and say, yes, you are that thing. You should go ahead and start cutting your parts off. That's what we're asked to do under the guise of compassion. Compassion comes from Latin, two words, cum passio, means to suffer with, right? To be there for the person and with the person and to ground them, you know. And instead, what we're being asked to do is not that at all. What we're being asked to do is to do the opposite, to say, yes, you don't matter. Yes, you should be confused. Yes, you should be lost. You know, go ahead and chop some parts off and we'll pay attention to you. That's not compassion. We've replaced real virtues like true compassion and replaced them with exalted vices like cowardice. Because that's what we're doing. Our advocation of tolerance above all else, tolerance even for evil, it's cowardice that's disguised as virtue. And it's a lot easier. The virtues aren't easy to live. That's why they're virtues, right? And instead, what you've got is this encouragement that what you should really do is just encourage people in their errors. You know how easy that is? Someone's doing something that's wrong, and you're like, keep going. So easy to do that. It's a lot more complicated to say, I think that you're incorrect, and this is why. I think that you're hurting yourself, and this is why. That's a significantly harder thing to do. But we have a duty to do that, a duty to give a person the truth that he or she is owed. And there's a human cost to not doing that. There's a human cost that I think that we're seeing to not doing that, to being silent and to arguing that as a type of compassion or as a type of virtue. It affects real people who, I mean, we don't know how many people have been injured just by transgenderism alone, let alone the breakdown of the family unit. I mean, we're never going to have numbers to put on that. It's so exorbitant. It's huge. But there is a moral high ground, and there's a human cost to not taking it. So I would always implore you all to not be afraid to really step up and say those things, because even though it's harder, because it's harder to be virtuous, it matters to the human beings who are truly affected by these dangerous ideologies, because they're not without their damage. These are human lives that actually are massively affected, and so much of it cannot be reversed. So that's what we're conserving as conservatives. It's the civilization that was passed down to us as people of the West under the ban of Christendom. It thrived because it was built on a solid foundation, and it can again. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sarah. That was amazing. Has anybody any questions? Feel free to join the line over here. You were saying,
you have the courage to do the thing. Yes.
I was talking to a friend the other day and said that in his workplace, he had a coworker who is in a relationship with another woman. And he So I wondered if you had any advice on that.
Sure. I do think there's some prudence that's necessary that's going to come in there as to when it's appropriate to bring it up. But certainly, it's not usually in the place of the workplace to bring up your different relationships. So if the individual is talking about his relationships, I think it's always our place to say, hey, that's not okay, in the very least. So I wouldn't be the person to bring it up as the first mover there. But if the person's bringing it up with you, I think the worst thing that you can do, and it's an injustice to the person, is to assent to what he's saying. You should at least, in the very least, let him know that there's something mistaken about that. Of course.
First of all, thank you so much for being here. And that was an incredible talk. I wish that you could go on forever about this topic.
Me too. I love talking about it.
I'm very passionate about this too. You started by saying that a lot of conservatives are even afraid to say these things.
Yes.
But you're not, which is incredible. And I think some people are starting to be less afraid, but not enough. So I was just wondering if you had like an idea of like how long some of these things might take to solve some of these problems that you have identified, and just like how maybe we can go about talking to people about these things because it is so difficult.
Sure. We could fix it overnight if everybody would just come around. but recognizing that that's not the case, I think we have to notice what we actually do have available to us. Notice the people that are around us. I really think that building up communities is a huge part of what we ought to be doing, associating with people who share our values. And we've sort of lost the understanding of what it is to have a community. We've become sort of over-isolated, certainly way too individualistic. You can't fight battles that way. You certainly can't when you've got a collectivized left, right? And so what we need to be doing is building that up and speaking about this stuff as much as possible. There is a concerted effort by those in the media and entertainment to make conservatives feel as though they're alone. It's one of the main reasons that they don't have conservative figures that are well articulated in these mediums. It's not just because they don't agree with us. It's because by not having them there, by not presenting conservative views at all, they leave the person at home who's just watching the TV, who's engaged in media, to feel like I'm the only one who feels this way. And people who don't feel like they have others who agree with them are far less likely to stand up and speak. And so by speaking, including just to those who are in your life, those around you, you let people know that they're not the crazy ones. They're not alone. It's very normal to think about these things and to speak about these things. It's what we should be doing more of.
Two questions.
Sure.
The first one, do you think Eastern Europeans are doing a little bit better in terms of preserving traditional values than the West? Second question, we live in an increasingly offensive realist world where the projection of power matters more than traditional values. What I do together with my two colleagues over there is actually human rights in North Korea. You mentioned North Korea. So what would be your advice to this government, to like-minded governments, in terms of continuing to preserve human rights grounded in natural law? What would be your advice in terms of preserving our heart and soul on the foreign policy scene?
Sure. I'm going to start with the second question first. So in regards to what the government should be doing, I think we have taken the wrong approach towards a separation of church and state. And that's part of the problem is how does a government that denies the faith entirely then go onto the world stage and promote values? Well, which values, from where and why? How are you going to defend that? And that's part of the trouble is that we're trying to be so secular, so a-religious, and then we're exalting these other values, which aren't really values at all. Like we talked about earlier with the LGBT thing and all of that. We're exalting those, no problem. But actual Christian values, no, because that's associated with the faith. And that's the thing. This is a false dynamic of religiosity versus not. And so I really think that we need to move in the direction of saying, yes, we're a Christian nation. We have Christian values. And that really needs to be taken onto the world stage. I will say that. I know a lot of people won't. But I think it's important because otherwise you're talking back in vacuousness, because otherwise you have no standing upon which to reinforce this and explain why it is that these things are important. Because otherwise you'll have somebody else who's going to say, well, what about this other right? And they just made it up. And you have no response because you can't say, well, that's not a right because we're all talking in a very a-religious manner. There are no duties suddenly. The person has no purpose. And so you end up in this sort of nihilistic circular motion. And then your second question was about Eastern Europe. I'm kind of rare in this regard, in that I do think so. I think they do significantly better. I mean, you have, even in Russia, I know I'm not supposed to compliment them, but there where they ban, LGBT, things in media, especially the media that's geared towards children, that's such a basic step. The fact that we have this indoctrination that's coming on so that our cartoons have trans characters, that's atrocious and it's evil. And I was talking with Kimberly earlier about this, but it's one of these things as to how when you're a child, you don't really question what you're taught. You simply receive. You are receptive by nature. And so that's the trouble, is even when you become an adult, you just sort of accept the things that you were taught as a child as the sort of basis of truth, right? That stuff is just perfectly fine, perfectly reasonable. Yes, dogs did evolve from wolves, why question, and so on. But then the trouble is, when you're teaching them this stuff about gender ideology, they get to adulthood and they just sort of accept it because they were taught it by people that they had a right to trust, and yet were not fundamentally trustworthy. So that's the trouble. That's why we should be spending so much time defending what children are actually taught. And it's why, in a lot of ways, Eastern Europe is doing better.
Do you see any value, especially living here, yeah, where... we're surrounded by, we're in the belly of the beast, right? Around DC.
You said it.
any benefit or a lack of ferocity and a pragmatist approach to some of these, to natural law and common sense? Am I demoting Christian values by using a pragmatist approach to some of these theories? Like, simple example, the bathrooms. Mm-hmm. We're teaching girls to ignore their evolutionary instincts of safety.
Right.
The pseudo-sophisticated idea, right? Mm-hmm. Don't ignore the wolf in grandma's cloak. Okay.
Yep.
Ignore Little Red Riding Hood. But is there a pragmatist approach to that? Obviously, we have religious values that tell us, wait a minute. But is there any value in a pragmatist approach in an area like this?
We have religious values, but our religious values as Christian values are based upon what we can largely infer, right? That's what natural law is. It's the basis of what is natural. And so when I was talking earlier about how we can know that men and women are designed for each other because they fit together, like, it's kind of like that. It's an inference of what things are designed for. And so a lot of natural law arguments you can make without seeming explicitly Christian. Yes, it has been baptized and pulled into the Christian worldview, and it makes sense. However, I don't think it's often not the right move to say, I believe this because it is my faith. It is my faith because my faith is in accord with reason. However, it also makes sense that a man cannot be a woman. It also makes sense that if you're engaging in genital mutilation surgery, then it proves that, in fact, you were not the thing that you thought that you were. There is no basis upon which you can say to me, I have to change my physical body to match my mind and not my mind to match my body. It doesn't make any sense. And it hasn't throughout history. So I do think you can make what you call pragmatic arguments. I wouldn't really call it so much pragmatic. It's just natural arguments. It's kind of like this microphone. Like, it's a good microphone because it receives my voice and projects it, or because it records my voice, because that's what the microphone was made for, right? But if I use the microphone as a watch, it's not going to tell me the time very well, right? That's natural law. It's, we can look at what a person is designed for based upon, what does he do? What does he do best? What's his natural output? And that's largely the philosophical body upon which we built. And that doesn't require you coming into a room and saying, this disagrees with my religious beliefs. No, my religious beliefs are in accord with nature. I can make that argument because it is true, not simply because it is part of my faith. It is part of my faith. But choosing a faith isn't like choosing my favorite ice cream. Like, I just want this one. Like, no, this one is true, and that's why I hold it. That helps.
Um, I'm a huge fan, and I think you're wonderful.
Thank you.
I have a question related to what's in the news these days. You're a young woman, and you know young men. And how, I don't want to say extensive, is there a lot of Fuentism out there among young men?
Oh, well, it depends what you mean by Fuentism. Do you mean radicalism by that, I wonder? I think that you see a lot of them on the right, you know, most broadly speaking, I'll use that term. And I think that part of it is because we live in a time of such tepidity that I think that he's really attractive in that regard. Young men have a natural desire to be courageous, and that gets directed in different ways. But I do think that they have a natural desire to stand up and say something. And in a time that is as decadent and frankly evil as ours, I think there was a time there's this desire to say something that's very obnoxious and loud that wants to burn the whole room down. And you see that sort of reflected in that worldview. And so I do see a lot of young men that I associate with who at least agree with some of his notions, or at least appreciate the fact that he's not so tepid. Because especially in terms of conservatism and republicanism, you have so many generations of, it seems like, just tepid, let's talk back and forth about these, you know, fiscal issues and so on. And you've got young men saying something's really wrong, and it's not just about tax rates, even though that matters, you know. And so he gives voice to that. And so what you really need is a broader conservative movement that's willing to say things correctly in a strong way. Because we all need that, but especially young men, I think, really crave that sense of authority that is lacking from so many modern conservatives, especially because a lot of conservative male leaders tend to be more bureaucratic. Let's argue on the nuance and so on, which isn't a bad thing by itself. But if you're going to lead, you need to speak in terms of values, because they speak to the human heart. And that's what he's really doing. He's speaking to the human heart on these fundamental and foundational issues that so many other people want to not speak about because it gets the left upset. Well, I don't need to sit across from Bill Maher someday. I don't have any particular desire. And so what we instead need to say, it's not about how well we can interchange with somebody on the left. It's more about what do people need to hear, because what is the truth? Because that is the truth that they are owed, and that is our duty to speak.
Sarah, that was fantastic. Thank you so much. Let's give Sarah Kane another round of applause. Now, most of you know we have this really fun tradition here of gifting our mug with our favorite quote by Claire Booth Luce, which is, courage is the ladder on which all the other virtues mount. When we first started this tradition, it was a Yeti tumbler that we were gifting, but Yeti canceled us for having the words conservative women on our tumbler. And so here is a Grizzly Coolers mug, Sarah. We have copies of Sarah's wonderful book for sale, and she has generously agreed to sign copies of her book, and I hope that you will all join us for lunch. Thank you so much.